Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One word more for signal token, whistle up the marching tune. For your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon. With your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mod.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's February the 5th, 2015. I'm Andy Donner, and this is Radio Free Northwest.
Like the man, she's lonely croon, and the cows and blades were flushing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon, and the cows and blades were flushing at the rising of the moon.
Well, I suppose I'm not who you were expecting, and that an explanation is in order. Up until today, Harold Covington has hosted every episode of Radio Free Northwest. However, since we're currently running our Back to Basics material for the newer audience members, I thought I would introduce myself and review my own reasons for contacting the Northwest Front, and eventually coming home to the Pacific Northwest. Once again, I'm afraid our longtime listeners will have heard most of this material in one form or another, and once again, the party begs their indulgence. Now, don't worry, folks. I don't intend to talk about me the whole hour. Not by a long shot. Truth be told, there's not enough material appropriate for my purposes today to fill more than the first segment of our program. My goal is to stir some interest in the Butler Plan and the Northwest Imperative by sharing my own personal decision-making process. Once that's done, I'm going to select segments from very early RFN episodes to play during the rest of the program. When I first found the party, RFN number 32 had just come out, and I had a much smaller selection of material to listen to while considering the propositions the party puts forth on its website and in the Northwest Independence novels. I'm regularly approached by those expressing interest in the Butler Plan, and asked what I recommend for reading and listening material. Among other things, I always mention the early RFN episodes first and foremost, because they were so critical to my own evaluation of the Northwest Imperative and its potential. The bulk of the party's core concepts are contained in the first year of RFN, and it's a shame we don't repeat the material more often. I hope our new listeners will find it as edifying as I did, and I also hope our longtime listeners will give it the attention it deserves. I have to note, though politely, I believe those who have listened to RFN longer than I've known of the party's existence have become, shall we say, lackadaisical in their nationalism. But enough of that. As I've said, my name is Andy Donner. I found the Northwest Front in late summer 2010 and moved to Seattle, Washington in early fall 2011. I made the decision to come home to the Pacific Northwest while living in Kansas City, Missouri, because after weighing the claims and proposals the Northwest Front made about the necessity of bringing into existence our own independent, sovereign, all-white nation in the Pacific Northwest, and more importantly, the possibility of doing so via specific methods which are known to be effective when used correctly, I was morally required to involve myself. More to the point, every individual white nationalist the world over should feel themselves obligated to do precisely the same, since if we as a race are unable to accomplish this task, we face certain physical extinction not even a century from now. It's not every day someone comes to the conclusion that removing territory from the United States of America is the only way forward for their race. Would it were so. How, then, did I come to this point in my own thinking? Well, I would suspect I'm not so different from most of you. I was born into a decent, white, upper-middle-class, conservative Christian family. This gave me the distinct advantage of being raised in a healthy environment, such that I was able to make it to adulthood, more or less unscathed, by the various bad elements in modern American society. On the other hand, it gave me the distinct disadvantage of being raised in a Judaic Zionist Republican environment, such that I entered my adult life with all sorts of anti-white political beliefs, even though I was hardly aware of them at the time. With the exception of a period of a few years, I had very limited exposure to non-whites as a child, and absolutely no exposure to Jews. Everyone likes to think of themselves as a good person, and of course a good person isn't racist, so I didn't think of myself as a racist, but I was. I didn't outright hate other races, but I knew they were different enough that I preferred they keep to themselves and not bother me with their nonsense. I observed their behavior and never felt bad for them when they whined about anything, especially because they're so awful to white people around them. In my mind, racism was something you did or said rather than something you thought. I just assumed all white people thought like I did and had the sense not to say so out loud. My family was always fairly politically involved, so I was as well. It was immediately obvious to me that Democrats, the left, and communism held no substance worth mentioning and only ever caused harm. I would expect most hearing me can relate. Opposition to evil almost always solidifies itself into some sort of idealism, and this very idealism caused me to start noticing deficiencies in my given Republican politics, particularly during the presidency of George W. Bush. I had been raised to expect a certain amount of moral correctness from Republicans, but the Bush administration and other elected Republicans seemed to cave at every opportunity to actually fix society, even in small ways. During the 2004 election cycle, I briefly affiliated myself with the Constitution Party and considered myself a constitutionalist. After all, the Republicans weren't doing anything right, and there was no point in remaining one of them. My family and friends had been involved in the Republican Party long enough to understand how the party machinery worked. Believe it or not, they really do just throw elections and legislation. My stint as a constitutionalist didn't last very long, though, because I'm motivated by right and wrong. The same dedication to morality and justice, which led me to the Constitution Party, also led me away from it. I've gone into detail about these exact issues elsewhere, and as yet, they tend to upset people who are still engaging in worship of the Constitution of the United States, so I'll be brief here. My politics were shifting to the right, though they were not yet racist, because I was exposed to more and more ideas about right and wrong, and particularly how they affect governmental behavior. Suffice it to say that, as much as some of us may love it, there are ideological problems with our system of government, which I learned about through my continued dedication to reality as it pertains to societal problems. The practical takeaway is that the way we think of our idealized America isn't the way the world is supposed to work. I sought this knowledge out because I was increasingly unsatisfied with the potential of my current politics, and you all should do the same. Now, normally I would feel as though I would have to detail my concerns about societal issues, but it's not necessary today. Anyone who avoids becoming some variety of liberal, progressive, or red diaper baby early on in their life will eventually end up some variety of racial nationalist. Granted, it takes so long that most people with our politics seem to only go racial when they near old age, but that's neither here nor there. Our nightmare of an existence eventually drives any sane, normal, and respectable person straight into white nationalism. My racial thoughts from early childhood eventually became more and more prevalent as I noticed the things I dislike about liberalism and progressive politics consistently falling along racial lines. Right about the time I was coming to these conclusions, the 2008 financial mess happened. Though it's still not well known, that was actually a planned event, and it was triggered by major banks being forced to make loans to people who couldn't pay them back, or else they would be accused of racist lending policies. In other words, our society has all but gutted itself to hide the fact that race is real and it matters. From that point, I essentially was a racist before all else. Shortly after, as you all know, Barack Hussein Obama was elected to the presidency. In early 2010, with the help of the rest of the Democrat Party, he signed the Affordable Health Care Act into law. I'm sure you all remember, almost the entire white population of the country was dead set against the law. And with good reason. It was known up front that the only purpose the legislation would serve would be to make white America buy overpriced health insurance for the black and brown populations. If that weren't bad enough, the actual effects of the law are so horrendous that as I speak these words, the entire IRS is apparently being thrown into chaos trying to manage the fallout. And this is, of course, after its disastrously awful rollout during late 2013. At the time, Obamacare was passed into law. Even though I didn't consider myself a white nationalist, I more or less gave up on America for one very specific reason. The amount of white opposition to the healthcare law amounted to less than nothing in net effect. I actually started the formal process of moving to New Zealand since I heard it was white there. Well, it's not. At the time, top elected officials were white, but they did nothing aside from appoint nigger underlings to run the government for them. They also have a surplus Asian population. I concluded there would be no point and gave the effort up. A few months later, I found the Northwest Front on the internet. Oddly enough, the party was proposing exactly what I wanted. But I was skeptical on the grounds that creating a new country from territory belonging to the United States was, well, a bit of a stretch. Sure, the politics were sound, and the idea was certainly desirable. But actually doing such a thing is unheard of. Or so I thought. Harold Covington is the author of what was, at the time, a quartet of novels which he said gave the reader a look at the metaphoric picture on the front of the puzzle box. I was immediately curious and couldn't be bothered to wait for physical copies, so I found the now-defunct White Nationalist PDF website and downloaded them. If any of you want copies, just ask. The novels themselves are quite a bit of fun, simply because every other scene contains white people killing their racial enemies. But like in a few of the early Radio Free Northwest episodes, serious discussion was given to the idea of armed insurrection against the United States of America. The idea of operating a guerrilla campaign to sever territory isn't at all a new one, but it's something which, aside from the freedom fighters of the order, hasn't even been considered. Immediately, I was intrigued at the suggestion simply because it was just bold enough to work, and no one else in the white nationalist movement had anything else to offer. But could it really be done? The party's recommended reading list had quite a bit of material about the process of actually detaching colonial territory by means of asymmetric warfare. And I started in on all those books. Sure enough, if we were to actually make a go of this, it would work. I spent a little bit more time going over the party's other materials on its website at www.northwestfront.org, and I found nothing with which I disagreed. I still wasn't well-versed on the Jewish question, even though by this point I had enough exposure to individual Jews to know I disliked them as much or more as any other race. That didn't stop me from getting in touch with the party and requesting my introduction packet. After all of that research I did, I came to the conclusion I was obligated to begin the process of Northwest migration and Northwest Front involvement. Outside of the Butler Plan, there's nothing else for us to hope for as a race. Most European countries are very nearly overrun, and America isn't far behind. History tells us what happens when white people are outnumbered in their own countries. Further, there's no hope in system politics because even if white nationalists got everything they could ever want from the government, we would still have a demographics problem which will ultimately consume our civilization. We should each take these matters into account and investigate what is best for our white race in the coming years. No matter how daunting the task may seem, the Northwest Imperative is the single remaining viable option which will ensure the survival of the white race. Failure to participate amounts to the surrender of our race to its imminent death, and this is simply not an option. Either we will win the Northwest American Republic, or 100 years from now, there will be no more white people. At this point in time, it's incumbent upon all of us to critically examine our own contribution to the survival of the white race and whether or not we're doing the right thing in light of our impending genocide. I'll end by pointing out that if someone like me, who started life as a Zionist Republican, can throw their hat in with white nationalist revolutionaries, then the rest of you can too. Ideologically, it's where we're all headed anyway, and I'd like to ask all of you to please speed it up so we can get on with business. I began today's monologue by observing, my politics aren't really so different from the average white person's, and I genuinely believe that to be the case. That being the case, then, I implore each and every one of you to give the Northwest Imperative the consideration it is due. Here's Stan Rogers.
I often take these night shift walks when the foreman's not around. I turn my back on the coaling stacks and make for open ground. Far out beyond the tank farm fence where the gas flare makes no sound. I forget the stink and I always think back to that eastern town. I remember back 6 years ago, this western life I chose. And every day the news would say, some factory's going to close. Well, I could have stayed to take the dole, but I'm not one of those. I take nothing free and that makes me an idiot, I suppose. So I bid farewell to the eastern town I never more will see. But work I must, so I eat this dust and breathe refinery. Oh, I miss the green and the woods and streams, and I don't like cowboy clothes. But I like being free, and that makes me an idiot, I suppose. Come all you fine young fellers who've been beaten to the ground. This western life's no paradise, but it's better than lying down. All the streets aren't clean and there's nothing green, and the hills are dirty brown. But the government dole will rot your soul back there in your hometown. So bid farewell to the eastern town you never respect and a steady check in this refinery. You will miss the green and the woods and streams, and the dust will fill your nose. But you'll be free and just like me, an idiot, I suppose.
It's come to my attention that we have a late-breaking submission from some other contributors. Since there will be plenty of time in future episodes to drop in clips from RFNs gone by, I think we'll make some room for others today.
Greetings, this is Stefan.
And Annie.
This time, Annie's going to engage folks about some female perspective on some things related to family issues and what else.
We are moved, Anne and Stefan will go over some things about how we're getting our mail and things. But
right.
That might be of interest to some of you that have family members that are not as racially conscious as we are. Ours are, but they just don't like to get the literature in the mailbox. So
here's the thing. My folks are up in age, and my dad's 75. He's
right on board with us. Yeah. And everything we say and do and everything we think, and he is right there with us. However,
in general principle, he is. Now, how do we get back to a white country? He's given up. And I'm sure many in his generation are the same way, seeing the kinds of changes they are. And he's really afraid of the government and police and things like that. So
he doesn't want to see any of the literature come in to the house or anything like that, even if it does have our name on it. It's still, you know.
Yeah, so really, to solve that problem, we just got a post office box.
For those of you out there that can't give Harold a specific street address or your real name, I mean, people are worried about the post office box because the person there might see what they're getting. Well, your mailman does too if you're getting it at your house. So that's just an idea for that portion of it. Anyway, I just thought I would throw that in there. I am trying to get on the forum whenever these air, the night before or the night of the airing or when it goes up on the internet or the next day. So definitely over the weekend, I'll be checking the forum board as well. We had some questions and I posted answers, but I kind of wanted to throw that out there on the broadcast as well in case you don't check the forum. If you're not going to the forum, please do. Stefan and I have a page that we kind of update and I date it and add different pages just to kind of help you find what you're looking for. But one question was speaking to the women and having a women's perspective of all this move into the Northwest and all these changes that it takes to get to where we need to be. So I really want to address some of those things. Both of my parents are gone, so I don't have any ties other than Stefan and a son, and he is out on his own and pretty much brainwashed by the system. He calls me a racist, which we finally tell him he'll be glad that we are one day. We actually have a lot of education to do with him. So if you've got children, whether they're adult children or younger children that are telling you that you're racist and telling you that your views are wrong, you've got to give them a message back that lets them know that you're right without making it a battle. So that's one thing we point out on a regular basis. What are some of the things we point out?
Well, our son is nobody's bad. In his eyes.
Right.
No kind of person is bad.
Right.
A gay is just, you know, they're just different. They're just a little more feminine.
Right. Now, let me tell you, the one thing I think that you guys will find interesting, the whole gay thing, he actually, he has a Facebook account, and I don't agree with putting all your stuff out there on Facebook. So that's just one thing I don't agree with. But at some point, about 2 years ago, 3 years ago, he put a post on Facebook about a gay. He found out one of his friends was gay, and he was highly upset. And he put on there, "I don't know how your mother could love you and that gays should be dead." he had that strong of a feeling about it. What happened is somebody I knew called and said, "Did you see what he just put on Facebook?" I said, "No, he has it blocked because he doesn't like that I comment if he puts inappropriate posts up there." So, you know, that's another story in itself. I called him and I said, "What's going on?" And he said, "Oh my gosh." He had people going to beat him up in school. He was called in by the principal. He was called in. He was
a thought criminal.
Oh my gosh. Because what he put out there, they scared him so bad that now he thinks gays are just different. That's what they've convinced him because they scared him so badly for posting a threat. They considered that a threat. So that's just one of the things you have to think about as a mom and as a woman. When you have children that are not racially conscious, that's one thing, is you got to look at their perspective and and you know what you've taught them, and you know how you taught them. It's just a message. You've just got to give the message a different way. We all know if you try to force your opinion, they're going to rebel against it, no matter how right you are. That's just the way it is. So as far as moving, the other perspective I wanted to give you is if you feel like you're abandoning your family or you're leaving your friends, it is starting over. It's starting over in the Northwest. We are going to be there. Stefan and I have a lot of ideas of how to welcome folks and have things to do and make everybody feel at home without getting into each other's business too much, if you know what I mean. Kind of like some of the things that the church families do without the religion added to that, because that's something very personal. So just different activities and cookouts and things like that. So there's the friendship portion of you leaving your friends. The other thing is your friends would probably love to travel to see you, especially when you start putting pictures on your Facebook page of how white it is without even saying anything. If all your pictures have just white people in it, that's going to send a message in itself. If there are jobs up there and you know your friends can get a good job up there and make a living, you tell them about that. Oh, you know, they have so many jobs in your field. You guys should come up here with us. So that's one way to get your friends to come up. Parents who are older and who are ill, that is a real tough thing because you don't want to feel like you're leaving them. You've got to get up there and be able to get to a point that you're secure enough financially that should something happen, you can fly back and help them or drive back and help them. The other thing is get up there and get in a place where you can bring them up there with you, you know, if that's at all possible. I know how selling everything is and all that, but it can be done. There are companies that can help you do that. And when it gets to that point, do you want them staying where they are and having somebody breaking in and you getting killed or them getting killed? Or do you want to go to the Northwest, find a place for them, so when the neighbor gets broken in, you can go say, Mom and Dad, you need to come up with us because there's white people here and it's a much safer environment. That's what you got to get your mindset on is you're going ahead to prepare for their arrival when they get ready.
Yes, it's always hard to leave your family. It's hard to leave your friends. It's very good to have roots in a community. That's one of the things we lack.
Right. We've been talking about family and pushing about how family takes care of each other. And people have said, well, you're asking me to leave my family. So really, I'm not. I'm saying go prepare a place because things are breaking down and your adult children who have good jobs that can't be persuaded to move right now, at some point they're going to lose a job or they're going to be in a position where they need your help and they need someplace to go. And if you're already up there and established and you're set there, then they've got a place to come. So you're really preparing that for them and taking care of them in that way.
I can understand someone who maybe lives out in the countryside in Tennessee or someplace where
they're not really affected by it.
Yes. The thing is, it's a matter of time before places like that are enveloped. And there may be islands of places that, but is that where you want to be?
You want to be on an island by yourself or you want to be?
Do you want to be in a mountain somewhere? If you do and you can hold out like that with your community and with your family, I say great. I think that's not the situation for most people, though. I think most folks are going to see the situation deteriorate around them more and more and more until it's completely unbearable. And the older you get, the harder it is to go, the more you can't go.
So that's
why we're saying you do it now.
Right. And as for selling off your stuff and everything else, it is amazing what you accumulate in such a short time. We're surprised at what we've accumulated in just a few years that we didn't have before. It's pretty liberating to sell everything and know that I can go hit estate sales and yard sales and, you know, have a lot of fun just doing it a piece at a time again. If that's a concern or how are you going to move all this stuff? It's so heavy and you got these big heavy bedrooms. Sell it. We've had the most fun selling our stuff, and I know that sounds crazy, but
we just kept the important things. We kept the most important things that we wanted to bring, and we put them in storage, and when it comes time to go, we're just going to put them in
in the U-Haul
probably a medium-sized trailer, and that's it.
Right, but you know what? We don't have any big, heavy beds, and we don't have all that heavy stuff because we are a little bit older. We can't unpack all that and put all that up. I guess we could, but it's back-breaking work, and who wants to travel across the country dragging all that stuff when you really can make it up there and do without for a little while until you get started back over again?
Maybe not everybody, but I think most of us can. I think most of us can.
Right. So you ladies out there that are struggling with this or are having some issues, I have done my share of crying and selling some things. But part of that is I really feel like we've lost so much of what I thought our country was. It's a realization that I really do have to get to the Northwest in order to be able to live like I want to live. And that's among white people in a clean area. You know, with my own people, I'm tired of stuff being shoved down my throat. I'm tired of the gays and lesbians on TV. And I don't want to turn on the TV and see two women kissing. That is not what I want to see.
You're going to still see that.
No, I'm going to turn the TV off, just like I do now. But I mean, that just as an example, I want to be in an area that's predominantly not like that, you know. So the more of us that go up there, the more we'll be surrounded by other folks like us. So when you're leaving those adult children, just know that it's going to be a short period of time. And if they need you, and they are going to need you when they need you, you're going to have a place for them in a white area that they can come to.
Right. At least when you go to the grocery store, when you go to the gas station, when you go and interact with people around town, you're not going to have to put up with the apes and whatever other. There's a Walmart over here that when we go in there, it's disgusting. And you know what? Somebody told me, I just found out the other day.
A new tidbit from Stefan.
Yeah.
We love the trivia.
They built a newer Walmart in another town that is predominantly white. A little bit away from how far is it? 20, 30 miles away from this cesspool that we call it. And I can't say where, but I said, hey, is it different in this one? I told the guy that was working in the sporting goods department, he said there are so many people that come here from the other place.
Right. They drive 30 miles because they don't want
that
one. Yes,
they don't want to go in that one.
Right, right. And that's something common in this area is the white people kind of do patronize certain stores. And Walmart's not our favorite store, and we only go in there if we absolutely have to.
Yeah, who wants to go in the Made in China store? I mean,
right.
That's what it pretty much is anymore. When, you know, white people are struggling, so, you know, sometimes you got to.
Right. So just remember that if you're, you know, like I said, I'm on the forum. I try to log in. You can look and see at the bottom if I'm logged in. It just says, Annie, thanks for getting that set for me, Mac. And ask me any questions. I don't have all the answers. If you ask me a question, I may very well say, well, this is kind of what I think. What do you think? I want to know what you ladies think.
Well, Annie, I think what people want to hear from you is a female perspective, because we don't have a lot of female voices on RFN or elsewhere in the cause, really.
Yeah, come on in and send me a message, and we'll help you get set up on how to get some podcast of your own going and get them to Harold. Stefan can help you.
Right.
Tell you how to do that with whatever equipment you've got. It'd be great to hear from some other ladies. And I love hearing from the men that have questions that just love their wife so much and are so concerned about their wife making the transition. I think that is so awesome that you just got to be commended for that.
Right. And it's difficult. I know it is. I'm going to admit here, I'm going to confess that I was a National Alliance member a long time ago, and the nameless officer asked me at the time, back in the 90s, if my girlfriend was on board with what I was doing.
Oh, I bet you said no to that one.
I said no. I said she's completely opposed to everything. And he said, well, you've got a problem. And
we're not saying leave your girlfriend or your wife, because now that he's found one that's on board.
Well, he was so right.
Wasn't me.
No, it wasn't Annie. It was somebody completely different. And believe me, it is not going to work in the long run if you have somebody that is dead set against this.
Right, but you can still support the cause from where you are and have a place to come when they do open their eyes. So don't stop listening. And the same thing, if you're a woman that's got a husband that's not racially conscious, you can still support the cause. You can still do flyers and brochures or whatever.
Let me clarify here, make the distinction. There's a big difference between somebody who's just doesn't really care about the cause or doesn't think too much about it, maybe is afraid of it and things like that. That's different than somebody who, for example, donates money to the SPLC or...
What's the SPLC?
The Southern Poverty Law Center.
I just didn't know the acronym. Okay.
Somebody who's totally against, you know, who goes and hugs blacks in front of you or has gay friends and that kind of a thing, that's not going to work. But if it's just a white person who just, you know, maybe like our son.
Yeah, we're not going to tell him where we live. I guess we're going to have to at some point, but we haven't told him yet. He'll have to.
Well, they're still trying
to bring him in line.
They have to know where to go. You know, you got to leave the door open, I think, for those people.
Right, right. I love my son, and I raised him alone for 13 years, and something drastic happened. I asked for a divorce, and his daddy stepped up and decided to push everything that he and I had both been against for 13 years with the interracial dating. You just can't imagine. So if you've got parents out there that you're divorced from that are doing that to your kid, then... That's terrible, but you just have to deal with that and know that that child is going to see things for what they are at some point. If you just keep repeating that message, like Stefan says, and you notice he says our son, because it is our son and it is our daughter. And that's really, you got to do that. You got to look at that other person and just know that they just don't know any better.
That's right. Okay.
We're going long on time again. Go out there, send me some questions and chat with me. I look forward to seeing a message and, you know, what we say. We don't know everything. We're just telling you what we think and how we're getting up there. And what, you know, April, first part of May is when we plan to make our journey. So I challenge you to go find somebody to move in with and save some money and get on up there with us.
Our longtime listeners will recognize The Pict Song, which is a poem by Rudyard Kipling set to music and performed by Emerald Rose. One of the local comrades requested it be played again, so here it is.
How fast we can drag down the state. We are the worm in the wood. We are the rot at the root. We are the taint in the blood. We are the thorn in the foot. Though maybe we are not strong, yet we know peoples who are. Gladly we'll guide them along to smash and destroy you in war. We shall be slaves just the same. When have we never been slaves? You will die on the shame. Then we will dance on your graves. We are the little folk we. Too little to love or to hate. But leave us alone and you'll see how fast we can drag down the state. We are the worm in the wood. We are the rot at the root. And we are the taint in the blood. We are the thorn in the foot.
The following audio selection is from Radio Free Northwest, number 13, dated April 22nd, 2010. It discusses the theory of armed struggle as the only real means by which change can be brought about in a manner which will truly benefit the white race.
In the 1890s, the degenerate aristocrat Lord Alfred Douglas was Oscar Wilde's bugger boy. In one of his poems, Douglas referred to homosexuality as the love that dare not speak its name. There's a topic which the Aryan racial nationalist movement similarly has for years discussed only in whispers. It's time we came out of the closet and openly discuss armed struggle. I believe that it is still safe to do so if we use what Lenin referred to as Aesopian language, the language of fable. If we couch the discussion in the form of a general talk about certain aspects of human history and political dynamics. If even that's not safe anymore, I suppose I'll find out soon enough. What we need to do is avoid advocating, urging, or inciting any acts of violence against identifiable individuals or other targets. The feds have developed something they call the doctrine of the credible threat, which, of course, they've twisted almost beyond any rational recognition in such abominations as the Bill White case. I also need to once again strongly caution all of you to beware of any person or group who approaches you with some alleged plan for armed insurrection or premature illegality. Anyone who does so is either a dangerous idiot or else a police agent of some kind. I bear in mind the essential difference between direct action to bring about serious political and social change and the stupid illegal act. Direct action is organized and methodical behavior which inflicts serious damage against the occupying power through the loss of important personnel or resources. It's activity that improves the movement's image as serious revolutionaries to be treated with the respect which comes from the capacity to use force successfully. It's activity which demoralizes and confuses the enemy and correspondingly strengthens the morale of the movement and the white population as a whole. Finally, the most critical component of direct action is that the persons carrying it out are not apprehended or punished by the forces of the state. By contrast, the stupid illegal act is usually carried out spontaneously with little or no prior planning, often under the influence of alcohol. It's directed against minor targets such as street niggers, individual faggots or race mixers, etc., who are no real loss to the system, there being plenty more where they came from. Finally, the perpetrators are almost always immediately arrested and given crushing prison sentences, thus boosting the enemy's morale and bolstering the deterrent effect of the establishment's crumbling legal machinery, giving it a gloss of efficiency which it does not in fact possess. Such as it is, the Aryan racial nationalist movement throughout the world since 1945 has been distinguished by one remarkable characteristic that separates it from every other revolutionary movement ever known: a reluctance verging on the racially suicidal to engage in armed military struggle against the tyranny that rules us. Genuine politics is about one thing, the acquisition and exercise of power. All else is political hobbyism. parliamentary electoral politics as we know it is a luxury which the wealthy landed gentry of the 18th and 19th centuries who created liberal democracy could afford, but which a race on the verge of extinction cannot. Power, all power without exception, is in the final analysis founded on one basis, armed force. Napoleon said that revolution is an idea that has found bayonets. We have yet to find our bayonets. Religion, constitutions, civil laws, custom, and all the various social institutions for reinforcing acceptable behavior, which means submission to authority, all of these have their place in a state's power structure, but without bayonets, they're meaningless. All power, without exception, is initially acquired through armed force or through the imminent threat of armed force. Some revolutions are bloodier than others. The Bolsheviks slaughtered millions, while the National Socialist German Workers' Party came to power in Germany after somewhat less than 1,000 deaths and 14 years of street fighting between the party's paramilitary formations and the communists. But all modern states, without exception, were originally brought into existence by men who fought for power with weapons in their hands. Both persuasion and coercion are necessary to carry out a successful revolution. Neither element alone can succeed without the other. All the propaganda, all the popular support, and all the legal activity in the world are useless if the state can fall back on armed force to maintain itself and destroy opposition. A revolutionary movement without an effective armed wing is doomed to perpetual futility and eventual defeat. Now, the formulations I just stated are by no means original with me. They're as old as statecraft itself. I simply happen to be the only American racial nationalist who is willing to discuss them in public. These truths are obvious from even the most cursory examination of human history. They're also obvious from reading today's headlines. It is a demonstrable historical fact. Pursued with sufficient persistence, ruthlessness, military expertise, and fearless disregard for the consequences, armed struggle eventually works. Why, then, do the white males of the 21st century, representatives of a race facing literal physical extinction, persistently refuse to utilize the gun, the basic tool of power which is understood and applied without hesitation by the most savage African tribal leader and the most corrupt Latin American despot? I could give you all the usual cliche responses I've been throwing about for years, but we need to go deeper than that. Our reluctance to face up to the reality of armed struggle's pivotal role in social and political change goes beyond simple garden variety cowardice or laziness. It reaches into the deep-rooted psychological malaise which has pervaded the entire white racial resistance movement throughout the Western world since 1945. This psychological and spiritual condition is difficult to quantify. The late Dr. Revelo Oliver once posed the famous question, "Have we, the men of the West, lost the will to live?" Down through the years, I have often observed that the white man in America seems to be in the grip of a kind of collective death wish, a mysterious and inexplicable will to failure. Now, I am by no means the first to notice this phenomenon. One of the best articles the late Bob Miles ever wrote was in the aftermath of the Fort Smith sedition trials of 1988, when he pointed out in his From the Mountain newsletter that the acquittals in that despicable case, instead of heartening us and encouraging more activism, resulted in an avalanche of sullen defeatism, smears, carping, and dog-in-the-manger petty bickering throughout the movement. Bob pointed out something which is crucial to understanding why we have gotten virtually nowhere for the past two generations. Over and above the preponderance of outright fraudulent leadership who are in it for the money, the movement has been controlled for years by elements who are deeply pessimistic, defeatist, lazy, lethargic, and mired in profound depression over Aryan man's terrible present situation and our more terrible prospects for the future. We are an army of Eeyores. It's difficult to assign a precise point where the rot set in. The murder of Commander Rockwell will do for a benchmark, but the fact remains that for almost five decades, the bulk of the white right in North America has been led by men who are simply going through the motions. With one or two shining exceptions, such as the saga of the Order, the many attempts at white resistance which have occurred over the past 50 years have always had a dark, sinister leitmotif underlying them, the acidly poisonous idea that victory isn't really possible, that the white man is essentially doomed to extinction through his own stupidity, and the most any of us can do is to draw out the funeral ceremonies and eulogies as long as we can before getting on with the business of dying. When this attitude is taken into consideration, the reluctance seriously to discuss, much less to adopt, the one operational strategy 100% guaranteed to catapult us into serious politics in double-quick time then becomes comprehensible. Why risk one's life, health, and liberty on what is essentially an interesting but ultimately futile hobby? For that is exactly how most people among us regard the whole exercise in which they are engaged. To most of us, all this is nothing but a hobby. Furthermore, most of us are weaklings, and I don't only refer to physical fitness, I refer to spiritual and moral softness. I'm talking about the infantile, egotistical American demand for instant gratification of every whim. I'm talking about the attention span of a housefly that characterizes our present Beavis and Butthead generation. I'm talking about the deathly fear of even the slightest physical pain or discomfort, the deeply ingrained bone-idle laziness which keeps the butt of the white American firmly planted in his armchair, staring at the tube like a zombie. Almost nowhere in white American males do we find the attributes of the political soldier, the alertness to one's surroundings, which means survival in guerrilla warfare, the cool and steady hand that can pull a trigger at close range and watch the brain splatter or detonate a bomb without fumbling or hesitation, the mental agility necessary to stay one step ahead of the pursuing police and the government troops. White people lack the total selfless dedication, the inflexible purpose, the iron self-discipline necessary to function under unbelievable pressure, to stand the unimaginable stress, and to live the life of the modern-day urban guerrilla. During my 25 years in the movement, I've met a few white men with that kind of inflexible will, hardness, courage, and integrity, but only a few.
I notice we're nearing the end of the program, and I haven't had a third music break. I apologize for that, since I know most of you really do enjoy the music on Radio Free Northwest. I also intended to play other clips from old RFNs which were suggested to me by a few different Puget area comrades, but we're just plain out of time, and we'll have to get to those in future episodes. Since our theoretic ideal time is now as close to an hour as we can get, I'll just drop in a third musical number. A comrade sent me this piece by Voltaire, and I got a kick out of it, so it's gonna get some play here. Enjoy.
Special touch to the gentlemen, I'm misfortune, to the ladies, I'm surprise. But call me by any name, anyway, it's all the same. I'm the fly in your suit, I'm the pebble in your shoe, I'm the bee beneath your bed, I'm a bump on every head, I'm the heel on which you slip. The devil tips his hat to me. I do it all because I'm evil, and I do it all for free. Your tears are all the pay I'll ever need. While there's children to make sad, left to pick, while there's grannies left to trip down the stairs, I'll be there. I'll be waiting round the corner, it's a game, I'm glad I'm in it, cause there's one born every minute. And it's so easy when you're evil, this is the light you see, the devil tips his hat to me. I do it all because I'm evil, and I do it all for free. Your tears are all the pay I'll ever need.
Comrades, I know this has been an unorthodox episode of RFN, and I appreciate your sticking it out with us. I would imagine the constant repetition is starting to grate on our long-term listeners' patience, so I and a couple of other comrades sat down for a good old-fashioned panel discussion last weekend in order to come up with some new material for you which could also be geared toward the newer audience. Don't worry, we have not abandoned you. That's all the time we have for today's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98194. You can also go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. Hail victory, comrades. We'll see you next week.
And hurrah, my boys, for freedom is the rising of the moon. Steps up.